know, we're looking at Yaakov's encounter with Esav. And I had mentioned that the Ramban brings some opinions that there actually was an Aveira for Yaakov to even try to contact Esav. There was no reason for that at all, because until he contacted Esav, there was no indication that Esav was looking for trouble. It could have been for Kerek. The very fact that Yaakov sends all these gifts, so he shows how wealthy he is, that that created jealousy and the like, and therefore there was antagonism. Chazal make another point in the negative, and that is a number of times he refers to Esav as Adoni, my master. And in fact, if you count the number of times that he mentions Adoni, it is 8 times. He mentions Adoni 8 times, that he calls Esav master. Now, if you look at the very end of Parshas Vayishlach, at the end of Parshas Vayishlach, the Torah gives us the yichus, the future lineage of Esav, at least up to Matan Torah. In other words, it's very interesting that it says, if you look at Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Eila Hamlachim Asher Molchu B'Eretz Edom Lifnei Melech Lifnei Yisrael. These are the kings who ruled in the land of Edom. Now, where is Esav's land? Esav's land is called Mount Seir, but that is basically around northern Saudi Arabia. So it's south of the Negev, down there. That is where Esav eventually was. So the Torah says there were 8 kings that Esav had before there was a king of Bnei Yisrael. So first of all, there is a real problem here. The Eben Ezra talks about this. Well, wait a second here. Who was the first king of the Jewish people? The first king of the Jewish people was Shaul HaMelech. That's correct. That is way after the Torah. Is the Torah telling us things that happened? And it doesn't even say it's the future. It doesn't say this is what will happen. This is declaring a past event. These are the 8 kings who ruled before there was a melech for Bnei Yisrael. Now, if you're carrying the story up to Shaul, how could that be? Shaul was after Matan Torah. So there is a very, very controversial Eben Ezra. It's a famous Eben Ezra, and some people say you're not allowed to say it, you're not allowed to mention it. And the Eben Ezra may have meant something else, but the Eben Ezra is Merames. He says it in a very riddle-type way, that perhaps there are historical interpolations that were added to the Torah later by the Nevi'im. But again, we know that under the Rambam's view of the Yud Gimel Ikrei Emunah, we cannot accept that. In other words, there were Rishonim who grappled with the idea that it is possible that some historical things were added to the Torah. The Eben Ezra actually mentions it. But as I say, for most views, this would be an apikoros. We're not allowed to entertain such an idea. Yeah.
If that's so, how can if people would hold that out, he would be like an apikoros for saying that?
Yes.
How can we use him in, like, Gemara learning and all that other
stuff? Well, it is a good question. This goes back to the idea that Rav Yashuv said, that certain things were not apikorsis until there was a psak halacha that they were apikorsis, meaning to say, in the Eben Ezra's time, certain ideas were not yet definitively established. There was a machlokas rishonim, in other words. But once it was paskind that we have the Yud Gimel Ikrei Emunah, then those other views become rejected, meaning that Rebbe Yashuv wanted to say that some ideas might be apikorsis today and would not have been, the same ideas wouldn't have been apikorsis 1,000 years ago, just as Beis Shammai was permitted to follow Beis Shammai, even though today you're not allowed to be permitted to follow Beis Shammai. Yeah.
Where does the idea of someone being apikoros coming from? Is it an idea they were raised from, or the idea of...
Well, it's clearly in the Gemara. The 11th parak of Sanhedrin talks about people that are called heretics, apikorsim, that don't have a share in Olam Haba. Now, the idea of what makes a person an apikoros is when he rejects fundamental principles of the Torah. But the Torah itself does not use the word apikoros. In fact, the word apikoros just means Epicurean was a Greek, Epicurus was a Greek philosopher. That's also, it's a later word.
How could the rabbis then have the authority then as late as the Eben Ezra to decide let's not be coarse and let's not. Because like with Hillel and Shammai, fine, we had a Sanhedrin then. So the Sanhedrin could decide. But without a Sanhedrin, how could the rabbis that late in history go about deciding what
well, you know, it is a good question, but once again, just as there is a halachic process in matters of halacha, so too in matters of what is considered to be acceptable faith, there are inyanim gedolim of every generation have to look. They look at the sources. They don't just make it up. They look at Chazal. They look at the sources in the Torah, and they determine what is the appropriate view for Abi Yisrael. But again, this is a controversial issue. I don't want to talk a lot about it today. There are those who say in matters of emunah, there is no such thing as a psak halacha, and by that they mean, as long as what you say has a makor in Rishonim, Achronim, Chazal, then the fact that most Jews, most Gedolim say it's not a right belief, only means that you're in error, your belief is erroneous, but an erroneous belief is not an apikorsius of belief. In other words, their svara is, if the Eben Ezra could say it, then why can't I say it? I'm just following the Eben Ezra. Right, so that's a big machlokas. Is there such a thing as a psak halacha in making something apikorsis? Rebbe Yashiv said there was. Others say that's not shayach. It's not shayach to say that the Eben Ezra who said something was not an apikoris, but if I say the same thing, I am an apikoris, when all I'm saying is what the Eben Ezra said, so how could I be an apikoris if he wasn't an apikoris? And to say, well, when he said it, there wasn't a psak, and when I say it, there's already a psak. Some people have, they say that's not a logical distinction. But be it as it may, I just want to point out, if you don't learn like the Eben Ezra, let's say you want to learn like the Rambam, the mainstream Rambam, that chas v'sholom, we are maimin, v'yamuna shalema, that not a single syllable was added to the Torah after Moshe Rabbeinu's death, with the possible exception, which the Gemara itself says is a possibility, the last 8 verses about Moshe's death, there is one opinion that says Yoshua wrote that. So if that's so, how do you understand the Pasuk? These are the kings of Edom who ruled before there was a king of Israel. Who is the king of Israel that you're referring to if it's not taking you down to Sheol HaMelech? So the answer is, most Mefarshim say, that the Melech is none other than Moshe Rabbeinu himself. That in a sense, we consider the first king of Israel not to be Shaul HaMelech, although Shaul was the first one that had the title of Melech. We consider Moshe Rabbeinu to be a Melech. And in fact, in Moshe Rabbeinu's, in Zeis HaBracha, his farewell address, so this is all, another machlokas. We have a pasuk that we actually sing at Chasnas. Vayihi Bishurin Melech, B'Sasef Rashi Am Yachad Shiftei Yisrael. Right? You know that's a Hebrew Yeshurun, right? So what does it mean? Yeshurun is a name for the Jewish people when they're upright. In Yeshurun, there is a Melech when all the people are together. When all the people are together, the Melech can truly rule. So some Mefarshim learn the Melech is Moshe Rabbeinu. Others say the Melech is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're praising Hashem when there's Achdus, right? So that's another machlokes. But at least there is one interpretation that Moshe was the Melech in that Pasuk, and many Mefarshim say in this Pasuk as well, Moshe is the Melech. In other words, but be it as it may, so whether the Melech in Vayishlach is Shaul, based on the Eben Ezra's very risky suggestion, or whether it is Moshe Rabbeinu, what is the Pasuk saying? Esav was zeicha to kings, malachim, for generations before the Jewish people had malachim. Meaning Esav was assuming that a king for a moment is a symbol of power and influence, what it's saying is Esav had power and influence many generations before the Jewish people had power and influence. Now why is that important to know? So listen to what Chazal is saying. Because of the 8 times Yaakov called Esav my master, and Yaakov was mevatel himself to Esav, and Yaakov subjugated himself to Esav, there were 8 generations where Esav had ascendancy in the world with kings before there was a melech in Am Yisrael. In other words, that's the getter of being mashpil. One should not be mashpil oneself to Rishayim. Now, this is already a bit of a controversy, because sometimes the Gemara in Brachos says that if a Rasha is very successful in the world, it is good not to antagonize him. don't know if you remember the Gemara in Brachos, that, you know, sometimes just lie low. Don't make a big deal. Don't try to fight him. Don't try to argue with him. That's sometimes. Other times we talk to say that you have to fight Rishus in every way possible and don't acknowledge any superiority on the part of the Russia. Now, similarly, the Gemara says like this. We know Amalek is the grandson of Esav. We know this. Esav's oldest son was named Eliphaz, and Eliphaz cohabited with a maidservant, Timnah, who was a maidservant, and from that union came a man. Amalek was a person. Came this man, Amalek, and Amalek is, of course, the ancestor of this nation that represents the epitome of evil. Let me digress for a moment. There is an amazing vort for Rav Chaim Shmulevitz that gives a person great, great pause. And as Rav Chaim Shmulevitz points out, you know, Amalek is like the worst nation that ever lived, right? To eradicate Amalek, totally, totally evil, irredeemable, etc. The Gemara says that Timnah, Amalek's mother, actually wanted to marry into the Jewish family. She wanted to marry Yaakov Avinu's children. And she was rejected as not being worthy. So because she was rejected, but she so much wanted to connect to Avram's mishpacha, if she couldn't get into the good part of the family, she went to Esav. But her kavana was to be mizdabek to the Zera Avraham. And out of that came Amalek. So you know what Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says? Amalek comes from rejection. When you take a person who wants to serve Hashem, who wants to learn Torah, who wants to go to yeshiva, and you tell them they're not good enough, they're not worthy, but dafka from that is how you get Amalek. In other words, this is Rav Chaim applied this lamaisa. You know, Rav Chaim was a Shiva of Mir. And, you know, Mir was only a fraction. Mir was not 7,000 people in his day. It, you know, maybe it was 500 people, 600 people at its height. But still, there were issues about accepting people, telling people to leave. And sometimes, you know, a guy doesn't go to Seder. Do you kick him out? Do you tell him go somewhere else? And Rav Chaim was extremely reluctant to ever ask somebody to leave yeshiva, because this is his lesson. He said, you kick somebody out, you might be creating a Amalek. He says, you don't kick people out until they become a very negative influence on others. Remember that, that's a separate question, that when they're influencing others, then you have to take care of that. But to stamaza, kick a guy out, even if he's wasting his time, he says, v'derech klal, you know, better here than the street. You know, all right, you're wasting time, right? You're in a yeshiva there. There's davening, whatever it is. There's something there. So that's the kayach of Amalek. But why am I bringing this up? I'm bringing this up here for the following reason. The Gemara in Bava Basra says that Amalek will only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not the children of Leah. The children of Leah will never be able to defeat Amalek. And we see this throughout Jewish history. The first war against Amalek in the desert, when Amalek attacked us, was waged by Yehoshua ben Nun. That's Yehoshua ben Nun's entree. That's his first appearance in the Torah, when Moshe makes him the general to fight Amalek. In those days, he wasn't Yehoshua, right? His old name was Hoshea, and he was the one. Now, what tribe is Yehoshua from? Ephraim. Who is Ephraim's father? Yosef. Who is Yosef's mother? Rachel. Right. So the first war against Amalek was led by Zerah Yosef. The first king of Israel, not Moshe, who was given the commandment to wage war against Amalek, was Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech is from the tribe of Binyamin. That's also the children of Rachel, not the children of Leah. And because Shaul did not kill Agag, who was the king of Amalek, so Agag impregnated somebody, and that person became the ancestor of Haman. And David HaMelech was not able to finish the job. Why didn't David finish the job? Again, spiritually, David, who is from Yehuda, from Leah, is not able to do it. The story of Purim, Mordechai and Esther, who are from the tribe of Binyamin, Zerah Shaul, their descendant from Shaul, were able to defeat Haman, who is from Amalek. We talked the other day about Mashiach ben Yosef, that before there's Mashiach ben David, there will be a Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef's job is to destroy Amalek to pave the way for Mashiach ben David. So you see a pattern that Amalek can be defeated only by the children of Rachel and not the children of Leah. Now, sometimes the children of Rachel are from Yosef, and sometimes they're from Binyamin, but they are always from Zerah Rachel. Now, why is that? Why is that so? So there are different reasons that are given, but one reason is given the following, that when Yaakov brought all of his children to Esav, all of them bowed down in submission, except the Medrash says Yosef did not bow down because Yosef stood up to protect his mother in the case Esav would try anything wrong. So, the only two Shvatim who were not Mishtachaveh to Esav were Yosef, and Binyamin wasn't born yet. Binyamin is not born until afterwards. So, every tribe that bowed down to Esav will be subordinate to Amalek, will not be able to destroy Amalek. It is only those Shvatim that were not Mishtachaveh Esav that will have that koach, right? So you see that Chazal considered this obsequiousness, this bittul, this submission to Esav, to have been a dangerous thing. That is why Esav had Malucha 8 generations before Am Yisrael. That is why, I mean, what would have been Chas V'Shalom if even Yosef would have bowed down, and let's say Binyamin would have been born and bowed down? Then it seems to be that we would have had no koach at all to go against Amalek. You have to understand, everything the Avos do has long-range significance for the history of the Jewish people. This is called Masa Avos, Simen Labanim. Whatever they do, that creates, you know, even if it's a small gesture, that creates the foundation of everything that's going to happen to us, right? So bowing down, what's the big deal of bowing down? But that bowing down, it's like when you're, when you build something, when you build a bridge, let's say you're trying to span water. So even if you're off by a quarter of an inch or a tenth of an inch, by the time you get to the middle of the river, you know, the two halves are going to be really far apart. So little deviations at the beginning of a process turn into big, big flaws and big, big problems later. And this was the union of Mishtachaveh Esav and the light. Okay. Now, we then come on that the night before Yaakov meets with Esav, right? The night before Yaakov meets with Esav. So the pasuk says, Vayivaser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov is all by himself, and he has a wrestling match with someone that is described as a mysterious man. That's what it says. So first of all, the question is, why is Yaakov by himself? So the Chumash tells me, Yaakov had already taken his family across the river Yabok. Right? That's the final river separating him from Eretz Israel. He already brought them there. But he went back. He went back after everybody already crossed. What did he go back for? So the Gemara in Chulin gives us the very enigmatic comment, oh, he had forgotten some small jars, and he went back to get those jars. Why did he do that? So Rashi quotes the Gemara in Chulin, Sadikim chaviven lahem mamonam yoser midufam. A tzaddik loves his money or property even more than he loves his body. He's willing to almost endanger himself, to go back in the middle of the night to a dark, deserted place. Of course, he didn't know he was going to encounter this guy. Because, you know, he left his pen behind. He left his paper clips behind. He left some little things. He can't leave that there. Wow, that almost sounds like, you know, the anti-Semitic slur that, you know, Jews are cheap. You know, they got to go back for all of their things. What's going on? And a tzaddik? A tzaddik loves his money more than his goof. What's shayach such a thing? A tzaddik is poresh from gashmias. A tzaddik is not osek in dizinyanim. So the Maral says really very, very pashut, and that is, the idea is the following. The righteous person, and certainly Yaakov Avinu, but you know every tzaddik with his madrega, understands that everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him is supposed to be used for Avodas Hashem. If Hashem gave the tzaddik 5 paper clips instead of 4 paper clips, he knows that there's a reason that he has to use the 5. So for the tzaddik, there is no such... So on one hand, whatever Hashem gives him, he's happy with. If Hashem just gave him a piece of bread, then that's all I need, and I'm very happy. But if Hashem gave him a lot of bread, it has to be that there's a tachlis. And the Mepharshim point out that when Yaakov and Esav describe their wealth, they use different lashonos. Yaakov says, yesh li kol, I have everything. Esav says, yesh li rav, I have an abundance. Now there are two ways of learning it. There are actually two different ways of learning it. One way of learning it is that Yaakov says, I have everything I need, I'm sameach b'chelko, I rejoice in my lot, I don't need any more. Esav can say, well, I have a lot, but it's not everything I want. I would like more. In other words, Esav is basically saying, I have a lot, but I want more. But some of Farshim give an opposite twist, mamish opposite. They say, Yaakov says, I have everything I need to serve Hashem. Esav says, I have more than I need. A tzaddik can never say, I have more than I need. Maybe, of course, I have more than I need for my own personal taiva, that's fine. But to say, a Russia could say, it's superfluous, because anyway, what do? I use my money for frivolity. All right, so after a while, how many millions of dollars do I need on gambling? So I can say, I have a lot more than I need. Although the truth is, typically they don't say that either, but you know. But Esav could say, I have more than I need. But Tzaddik cannot say, I have more than I need. Because if I have it, I need it. Now, why do I need it? That's a whole cheshbon. I need it for tzedakah. I need it to support my family. I need it to do mitzvahs. That could be a million reasons. We certainly don't mean I need it for my own personal taiva. But memela, for Yaakov Avinu, even if you're missing a small, insignificant thing, you want to find it. Because bahashkacha, when you live a life where every single thing has a purpose, emetayelis, then even the paper clip, you know, that has to be a reason Hashem gave it to me, so I'm going to look for it. Right? So that's what it means that tzaddikim have a love of their mammon, because they know that whatever Hashem gave them has a purpose, has a tachlis. There is no waste. There is nothing superfluous in life because Hashem gave it. Now again, maybe it's for tzedakah, but the stamas that go to waste, you know, that can't be. That is why, of course, the Torah itself has an issur in the Torah, right? You're familiar with this, bal tashchis. Now, in the context, the Torah is talking about you're not allowed to destroy a fruit-bearing tree. And that, in fact, is an Isser D'Oraisa, to destroy a tree that bears fruit. I remember in Rebbe Yashev's house, in his apartment, in the building, he walked into the lobby, and there was like a tree growing, and going on a hole in the roof where the tree went through. So you could think, well, it looks like a fancy hotel lobby. They have, the building was not a fancy building, so it's incongruous that you have this like one tree growing with a hole in the roof. But the answer is that when they built the building, I don't know how many years ago, 80 years ago, it's not a new building. When they built the building, there was a fruit tree there, and people said you're not allowed to cut down the fruit tree, so you have to like build a building around the fruit tree. It's a major thing. So that's a fruit tree. But Chazal say, Morin Bava Kama, that lo tashchis, not to destroy. Baal is just kind of Mishnayic Hebrew for lo, like Baal Yerah. That Chazal say that this is not only for fruit-bearing trees, but one does not destroy anything for no reason. One does not throw away food. One does not rip up clothing, etc. All of these things, right? So Judaism is pro-conservationist of resources. We say that if Hashem gave it to you, there's a reason. It's significant. And that's why a person has to take care of things in that way. In fact, there's an interesting quote from Revelio Lapian. Revelio Lapian says, okay, this is a total digression, but it's a very, very beautiful quote. You know, there's a statement that says that the reason why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed is because they didn't make Birchas HaTorah. They didn't say blessings on the Torah. Right. So the question is very obvious. The reason why the first place of Mikdash was destroyed is because of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichus Damim, the worst Averis in the world. Why do you come on to, they didn't say Birchos HaTorah. I mean, that's an Avera, but that's not as chomor as Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichus Damim. So Rav Elia Lapian used to explain it based on a teaching of Chazal. If you remember the book of Malachim, David HaMelech, towards the end of his life, was shivering. He was very cold. And they covered him with blankets, and he was still shivering. He was cold. So the Gemara says, why was he not able to be warmed up? Because it said, anyone that treats clothing with disrespect is not going to be warmed from the clothing. And when David was being chased by Shaul, at some point, when Shaul was sleeping, or there are two different stories. One, Shaul is in a cave relieving himself. The other is he's sleeping. David cut away a piece of garment to show Shaul that I could have killed you and I didn't. So Chazal say he was mevaza beged. He treated clothing with shame. So if you treat clothing with shame, it doesn't give you warmth, even though it's different clothing. In other words, the only thing that protects you is when you treat something with kavod. If you don't treat it with respect, it doesn't protect you. That's what you see by clothing. And that ties into Baal Tashchis. The physical property that Hashem gave us to serve him has a purpose and has a tachlis, and you treat it with respect. But my digression is, Rav Elia applies this to Birchas HaTorah, and that is this idea. If clothing is not going to protect you unless you show kavod to it, kal v'chomer, the Torah is not going to protect you from sin unless you're machshiv the Torah and you treat it with respect. So, here's his big chiddush, beautiful pshat. When the Gemara says the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because they didn't make Birchas HaTorah, he doesn't mean that that was the sin that caused the Chorban. The sin that caused the Chorban is Vadai Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichus Damim. But the question is, since they were learning Torah, why didn't the Torah they learned protect them from sin? It's like saying that, you know, you learn in yeshiva, morning seder, and then you have an hour and a half for lunch, so you go to town and you rape, murder, and rob a bank, and then you make it in time for the afternoon seder. That's not possible. How can a person learn and shtag and be connected to Torah Hashem, and then you do Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichus Damim, you know, Bein Hazman, Bein Hastar? The answer is, they didn't make Birchas HaTorah. That refers to their attitude. They looked at the Torah as a subject. They didn't appreciate it as a gift. Memela, if you just like, right, see his demian, just like if you're not machshiv the garments don't protect you. If you're not machshiv the Torah doesn't protect you. And yes, you could learn 4 hours in morning seder and then rape, pillage, and rob a bank at the same time. Okay? So, the shtickle about Birchas HaTorah, that's an important mussar anyway, to be machshiv the Torah, to look at it as a gift, to appreciate it. That's what a bracha is. That's thank you, Hashem, for giving us this gift. But the thing I'm bringing in, okay, but that point is not Nogeyar Parsha. What's Nogeyar Parsha is this yesaid that even in the Olam HaGashmi, everything was given to you for a purpose, and therefore you have to treat it with respect, and that is why Yaakov Avinu goes back by himself to pick up the Pachim Kitanim, because for a tzaddik, Esav can say, I have more than I need. A tzaddik can never have more than he needs, because if he has more than he needs, he wouldn't have it. He understands that everything has a tachlis, everything has a purpose. Okay, we'll stop here.